Welcome to Can I Keep You, the official podcast of the Devon Sawa Appreciation Society. I am one of your hosts, Allie, and my cohort.
Hi, I'm Lan, and today we are talking about the 1995 live-action film, Casper. Casper was directed by Brad Silberling, written by Sherry Stoner, Deanna Oliver, produced by Colin Wilson, and starring Christina Ricci, Bill Pullman, Kathy Moriarty, and Eric Idle.
Oh, and Devon Sawa, of course.
Sort of. So my first question to you, Allie, why do you think people our age associate this movie so hard with Devon Sawa when he's in it for like 5 minutes?
Because I always thought he did the voice of Casper also, but now I'm thinking that I'm not correct.
No, he didn't do it.
Okay. Well, that's my... Okay, so when I was... In 1995, I was 9. I am almost positive that I actually saw it in the movie theater. I'm pretty sure that I did, because, like, I loved Hocus Pocus, and this had a spooky house also, so it was, like, a similar vibe. And I think one of my parents was very into, like, the old Casper cartoons, like Wendy and Casper, the comic books.
Yeah.
Whatever media came before this movie, so... I think it's comics. I think it's comics from the Archie people.
Yeah, it's based on Casper the Friendly Ghost, which was created by Seymour Reed and Joe Oriolo. I'm probably not pronouncing that right, but they might be dead. So here we go.
But yeah, so I'm pretty sure like one of my parents genuinely enjoyed that media previously. I'm feeling like it was probably my mom, because she was like very much like Nancy Drew, Hardy Boys, Bobbsey Twins, Archie Comics sort of sugar situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like Hanna-Barbera cartoons, that kind of thing. So I'm pretty sure that we went to see this movie as a family.
I think we probably would have with me too, because my dad always recognized at a young age that his daughters were kind of weird, I guess, and liked spooky things. And also, I have been a really big fan of Christina Ricci since like literally as long as I can remember.
That's fair. That's totally fair. I don't have any memories of not being interested in paranormal things. I don't know where it comes from. Maybe like my love of fairy tales as a child, maybe like The Wizard of Oz having The Wicked Witch of the West and being like very about magic. Creature from the Black Lagoon, Universal classic sort of situation. I was always here for it.
I love Universal monsters.
You know, like I said, I loved Hocus Pocus. So I was like, witches, ghosts, everything. Let's do this. And then it was like, this movie is about a haunted house. And I was like, that sounds amazing.
And it looked like the trailer looked like it had a sense of humor too, which it wasn't just like, it's a haunted house. It's like, no, this is going to be fun because it's literally based on a kid's comic strip.
Yes. And I'm sure that like Monty Python also had something to do with my parents being willing to go see this film. Because Eric Idle is part of Eric Monty Idle. Python. Yeah.
You know, it's so funny. As earlier I was like, this connects to A Fish Called Wanda, which is a movie that I love because, nope, that's Michael Palin, not Eric Idle. And I just mix those two up so much, which is so embarrassing because, yeah, like totally grew up in a Monty Python house.
Yeah. So like, I was like, yes, this is awesome. I too wanted to live in a haunted house and have adventures because as a child, I had paranormal experiences that were not fun, which I may or may not talk about because I know that like ghosts and things are not everybody's cup of tea.
We'll see if there's anyone listening. Are ghosts and things your cup of tea? Email us at...
I believe it's canikeepyoupod@gmail.com. Tell us if you're into real life paranormal stories, even though that's not what we're here to talk about. Anyways, but I was very excited for the prospect of ghosts also being fun.
And the CGI ghosts. That was such a huge thing.
Yeah.
I read that there was like more CGI in this than in Jurassic Park, your first love.
My first love, because, well, Jurassic Park had so many practical effects. They had an entire animatronic T-Rex. The raptors were dudes in suits.
They just did such a good job of blending it all. It's insane.
And that's why it still to this day holds up and doesn't look cheap and shitty.
And is the best Jurassic Park movie. I don't think that's a controversial opinion.
And I think there's also like some kind of tie-in for me with Ghostbusters and like the Ghostbusters movies and the Ghostbusters real Ghostbusters cartoon and the ghosts in Casper having the same sort of blobby shape as Slimer.
Yeah, I actually have a real Ghostbusters t-shirt from the 90s.
That's phenomenal. But yeah, he was like a same, it was like a Slimer and the Marshmallow Man jammed together sort of soft ghost curves vibe.
When you say that, it makes me mostly think of Fatso, which I think we can all agree the entire identity around him is out of date and problematic. But Brad Garrett continues to be the voice of our childhood. I didn't realize that he only, like, he mostly has done voice work. Huh. And before Everybody Loves Raymond, he, like, basically only did voice work. But he plays Fatso.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That very, nobody has that. That's not his voice, but, you know, nobody has that, like, in your chest voice.
It just makes me think of Teddy from Bob's Burgers also, like, oh my God, Bobby. But yeah, it's sort of like, and the house was so cool.
That lobby, I still want to paint spirals everywhere. And it's not because of Tim Burton alone. It is because of the foyer of Whipstaff
Manor. So Whipstaff Manor is, I would say, like, is it, I want to say, like, it's like an Art Nouveau sort of a style, because yeah, it's not Art Deco. Art Deco is hard lines. Art Nouveau is like very organic shapes.
And sometimes kind of melty and blobby. Is that a bad description? It's
like very much like organic shapes and natural shapes, and then like pretty ornate. Like there was like an ornamental sort of vibe to it.
Yeah, it's not like a lot of the Art Nouveau you see, because it has that, not in architectural sense gothic, but like in a 90s pop culture sense, like very gothic, like that spiral on the floor. Like nowadays we'd have that be like a white and black spiral, but like it's like that burnt orange red or whatever with the I can't think of another thing in any TV or movie that like has the vibe of Whipstaff Manor.
Hill House. Yeah, from The Haunting of Hill House, when I think of Whipstaff's library with the iron spiral staircase, same as Hill House.
You know what? Now that you say that, The Haunting, which is based on The Haunting of Hill House, that house also had, like, Whipstaff Manor had the whole, like, weird rides through it and everything that's not in the book at all.
I think it was, like, a very 90s vibe to blend that sort of fantastical architecture with... what's it called? It's not steampunk, but it's the same kind of idea of steampunk where things are like mechanized and automated and like the home belonged to. I feel like eccentric inventors were like a big thing.
Oh my God.
The 90s. Like,
Doc Brown shot off the whole thing, I think.
Well, because you had like Edward Scissorhands had a weird inventor guy in it, you know? And it's
a surprise.
Right?
Oh yeah. And at some point we have to talk about how House on Haunted Hill and The Haunting of Hill House have nothing to do with each other, but the book of Haunting of Hill House came out the same year that the Vincent Price movie, House on Haunted Hill, came out, and then The Haunting, which is based on the House on Haunted Hill. I can't even say it. It's just so ridiculous.
It's a very closed circuit of media that spawns and spawns and spawns itself. Perhaps we'll do a side episode on The Haunting of Hill House at some point.
Who knows? Maybe if people listen, we could always just do like a little mini series where you and I watch it and talk about it.
Right?
You guys are all game for that, right? Email us.
Because I feel like Hill House, in The Haunting of Hill House, is like what Whipstaff Manor is, the house that you see in childhood. And then when you're an adult and you return to that same place, it's actually Hill House. Do you know what I mean? Whipstaff Manor has that like safe, scary bubble wrap.
Whimsy,
yeah.
There's whimsy about it. All of that whimsy, once you go into it with Hill House, is like, it sits on your chest a little now. And you're like, oh, did it always feel this way?
You're like, something is not right here. Yeah. Something is deeply wrong.
And I think that house is so key to like the whole story. It's one of those hearts of a movie.
Right. Because of the relationship between Casper and his father and Casper's father's work, which is like, he's the brother of the ghost uncles, right? Like I would assume.
He must be
the brother of the ghost uncles. But like he's devoted his whole life to using his skills as an inventor that he developed to like make a whimsical breakfast making machine to conquer death. Also, if I'm not mistaken, Bill Pullman's character is like a ghost hunter?
Yeah. So I rewatched it for the first time in years. And I watched this movie like at least dozens of times when I was growing up. Right. Casper's dad was always an inventor and did all these whimsical things. And then his son died really young. That's why he turned to healing ghosts, I guess, for lack of a better term. And I will actually ask, how does he not have any unfinished business if he didn't get his son back to life? But I guess that's just a plot hole.
I posit it's because the uncles are still around. I feel like it also ties into a period where spiritualism was really big.
Yeah.
And everybody was trying to contact their deceased. Because if you look at the architecture of the house and the sort of time of Casper's childhood that he talks about with sledding and stuff being like a big wholesome deal or whatever, I would argue maybe like depending on what he did to contact ghosts, he may have had an experience where he thought that he had spoken to his child and their child was fine. Or maybe it was because the uncles were behind, so he knew that Casper wouldn't be alone.
Maybe. And then he just was never aware of the fact that his uncles were actually super abusive to his kid. Also, why did three grown men share a room? Just right? Asking.
Yeah. I have some like really specific questions about the family dynamic.
Also, did they like literally ever mention his mom?
No, they didn't.
Because I'm really getting like Batman vibes where besides the necklace, his mom is never mentioned. He's just like, my father.
So that's also like a super huge convention of 90s films where it's like a single parent household, because you just know that if there were two parents in the household, none of the action that kicks off the whole story of the film would have happened. Because if Casper had a mom, she would have been like, get your ass inside, you're gonna freeze to death. And he'd be like, yes, ma'am.
I think that a big thing with like single parents at that time was we had a generation where divorce was just happening. It wasn't a new thing. Divorce happened. And it was very, very real. And it wasn't just this like weird working class thing in the 70s or 80s. I think that's one of the things that I was drawn to with Casper. And Now and Then, actually. Christina Ricci plays a girl whose mom is dead. Most things, especially at that time, that had a single dad, the mom had to die because how would a mom just leave? But my mom did just leave. And so having Now and Then and Casper coming out in the same year, her characters don't have moms. It was definitely a really big thing for me. It's just a shame that in the 90s they had to kill the mom off in order to validate a single father.
But also like in the time period that we're talking about, like where Casper is sort of grounded, you could argue that like tuberculosis was a huge issue at that time, or even like any kind of illness. So like if the mom died in childbirth, died when he was small because she also got pneumonia, like what killed him? You know, there were tons of reasons for Casper's mom to be deceased and not part of the story.
And in the end, it's about fathers not dealing with their grief, right? Oh, and Kat's dad, we didn't get to that, is Dr. Harvey was a psychiatrist. And then his wife died after a sickness. And he became obsessed with the concept of unfinished business. And so like, because they exist and Kat was still a kid and they didn't get to grow old together, she must have unfinished business. So he's always looking for her while dealing with these paranormal things. And I don't know if you remember, but Casper sees a news clip for Dr. Harvey and he was like, ooh, because it showed Kat. And he was like, oh, she's so pretty, because she is just Christina Ricci. And then he like sends that to Kerrigan, and Kerrigan, like, he sends it to her TV.
Right.
And so manipulates this whole situation so that Dr. Harvey can come and his daughter.
I think it was because he wrote a book. He wrote some kind of controversial book that made him seem like he was a little off key.
Well, I think the fact that he sees himself as a psychiatrist for
living challenged,
something like that. And it's just like this PC bullcrap thing.
That is very confusing for everyone involved.
Yeah.
They think that he is the person who can rid this manor of ghosts so that Kerrigan can make money by selling it.
They think there's buried treasure.
Right.
Because Kerrigan's dad dies and leaves her nothing. He leaves it to all of his like charitable donations and they see a sort of map. And it turns out to just be like a treasure map from Casper and his parents playing when he was a kid, but they're like, obviously there's treasure in here, and they like want to get rid of the ghost.
Because there's like a whole underground situation that makes it seem really plausible that this guy would have treasure, because he clearly was eccentrically rich. Like, he had so much money. I don't know, maybe he invented like a toaster or something, like some kind of regular invention.
Or maybe he inherited family money. And that's why he got to go wild with his whimsy.
And now I'm thinking about Crimson Peak, because that house also, same vibe.
Same vibe, but more incest. Sorry.
Spoiler alert. No, but Crimson Peak, Tom Hiddleston's character, is basically like a funhouse mirror version of Casper's dad.
It's so upsetting.
Now you can't unsee it.
It's so upsetting.
Yeah, it definitely is. Same vibe for the house, though. It's got that, like, if Whipstaff Manor was just left to decay sort of situation going on. Also, that house was in great condition. Who's been cleaning that house?
Exactly. It's like, ooh, some cobwebs. Dude, that can just happen in anyone's house. You go away for, like, the summer.
Right. I'm like, was Casper cleaning the house? Like, does he keep it up? Because the uncles are obviously doing nothing. Or do they have, like, a trusted cleaning person that...
Oh no, I bet Casper did, because they treated him like a servant. I don't think they cared about that, but I bet he like did a little bit of cleaning up.
Probably
not all of it, because cobwebs.
He would have to, with the amount of food that is falling out of the bottoms of these ghosts.
Grossest scene ever. So gross.
Maybe that was an homage to Ghostbusters, because I think that happens when Slimer eats also.
Yes, it's also quite gross with that.
Yeah, it's just
It's just this moving through Slimer, whereas this one we got to do a lovely pan shot across the floor of all the food just
every single day. He would have a lot of cleaning to do. Also, super powerful ghost. You know, if there was like a ghost fight, Casper would win. He's got the kinetic energy to move food into a trash can and take it outside to be disposed of.
Yeah. Like, according to lots of other things, ghost lore, Casper's pretty powerful. It's just that he's too much of a softy, nice guy who has abusive parental figures.
Yeah, he's just a sweet kid.
Speaking of sweet kid.
Yes.
Malachi Pearson is the guy who voiced Casper. He didn't really keep with acting, but he did voice Casper for like the next 2 years.
Oh, was he also in Casper and Wendy with Hilary Duff?
Yes. And I think they did a revival cartoon show at that time. And he also voiced it for that. Apparently, Devon Sawa and him have kind of like connected in the past about it at like conventions and stuff, which is cute. And Devon's always just like, I don't know why I get all the attention. It's like, because we saw you and you were 15 playing a 12-year-old and you looked smoking hot.
Plus, it was so romantic. Like,
it was so romantic.
You know, she's there in her mom's dress and it's Halloween.
His mom's dress.
His mom's dress.
Did you not totally want that dress?
Okay, so like, yes. Just to circle back to the Christina Ricci thing. So as a child growing up, as a young person, like with dark, dark hair, because I've had dark hair always, like unless I dye it a different color, all of the heroines pretty much were predominantly blonde. The heroines were blonde, like She-Ra, who I aspired to be, blonde. Penny from Inspector Gadget, blonde. All of my dolls were blonde.
The 90s, man.
Christina Ricci, with her dark hair and lovely forehead, which I also have. You know, like, I don't have a forehead for bangs, I have a widow's peak.
It's very Willow of you.
Thank you. It's like a Bela Lugosi situation, is what I like to call it. But seeing this pale and dark-haired girl on screen being the hero of a movie and getting her like romantic sort of situation, like first budding romance happen, it made her really easy to identify with, especially when she was playing characters like Wednesday Addams and Kat. So Wednesday was like Wednesday. Kat was like by herself a lot
because she was isolated by her dad's solve grief. He basically wouldn't allow his daughter to process her grief because he could not process his. So she's isolated by basically also being an army brat too, because they won't stop moving. It's tragic. It's a tragic movie.
I was a weird little girl who just read books and played imaginary games predominantly by myself. And then, like, in now and then, she played this, like, really, like, tough, combative girl, and I was known to be loud and not obnoxious, but definitely opinionated in the same way. So it was really easy for me growing up to identify with the characters Christina Ricci played, because not only did she have the same sort of look as me, but she also played characters that I felt resonated with me.
Yeah, for sure. Me too.
So seeing her in that beautiful dress, getting to have that moment where she gets to be noticed by someone.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're digging deep into the feels today.
We're gonna do that all the time, Allie. Just accept it.
That's fair. But like, I was like, yes, like I would love to have this moment where somebody sees me and thinks I'm the coolest person.
Yeah.
Wants to be... Well, I mean, Casper clearly had like some hard eyes and stuff going on there. But at the same time, I was like, this person wants to be connected to you always.
Yeah, it's roots.
You know, this person never wants to leave you.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow.
Every now and then you'll find a special friend. I'll stop now. I want to bring up a couple things about Casper.
We're going to circle back to the actual topic of the episode.
Casper on Wikipedia is a quote supernatural dark fantasy comedy drama. Supernatural dark fantasy comedy drama. And I feel like that is such a vibe.
I would like a million movies in this genre. Where are all of my films?
Well, here's the thing is I looked it up. Here are four other movies that came out 1990. The Witches, dark fantasy, comedy, horror.
Definitely scarring. Yeah. Angelica Houston in The Witches, haunting, haunting.
Addams Family, 1991. It's described as a supernatural black comedy, which if you don't know what that means, just look it up. It's a death thing.
Yes.
And then 1993, Hocus Pocus.
Yes.
A fantasy, comedy, horror.
I love that movie so much more than most movies.
Also in 1993, Nightmare Before Christmas, a stop motion animated musical dark fantasy. And so I think with all these, what we're getting at is that they really don't know how to define these movies, but I would just call them children's horror or family horror.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel like the 90s were really doing this thing where they were like, I've heard from so many like Gen Xers and boomers on podcasts, which I love. I'm not like saying I hate their podcasts, but there's always this leaning towards like, oh, and then in the 90s, they were just making family movies and that's what we're stuck with now.
Okay, but like they were family movies that everyone could enjoy. There was stuff for adults in these films.
That's literally the whole point of a family movie.
Is so that, you know, adults will bond with their children about these films and then you can watch them all together as a family and no one is excluded.
Yeah.
But also you can have a rockin' sort of scary adventure together.
So looking at like what makes kids like us and like why do these movies speak to us so much, it kind of made me think of like the people who make them and all the links between it. Looking at the people who made Casper, Brad Silberling, the director, mm-hmm. series of unfortunate events.
Oh.
So Lemony Snicket is basically children's horror. I love mm-hmm. it.
And it also gave us like the career of Emily Browning as like a horror movie final girl sort of situation.
And she's always so very good in American Gods.
Yes, dead wife. But American Gods is the whole thing. When you refer to like kids like us, I and my friend Steph, we call ourselves hella weirdos.
Hella weirdos. I love hella weirdos for sure.
But I think that's, you know, kind of like when you say kids like us, that's kids who love like the Addams Family and Casper and Hocus Pocus and Practical Magic. And
aww. And so that like supernatural dark fantasy comedy drama is just like, I see that you cannot figure out quite what to put it under, but I appreciate the effort and please make more movies like that.
And speaking of recently, things that give me Casper vibes, if we're going to bring it on back to what made Casper such a lasting impression, it had a beautiful story. The chemistry between the cast was great. It was a fun family adventure. So it has that like nostalgia factor. it was just scary enough, but it wasn't so scary that you were like traumatized from watching it. And, you know, like we all wanted to be Christina Ricci floating in the party where like you were made fun of by all your classmates, but there's this one person who just sees you and thinks you're amazing. That's all we ever really wanted, most of us, right? As people, is just to have one person think we're awesome, platonically or romantically or whatever. Like, we just want someone to see us. And that, I think, is part of what makes Casper hit so emotionally for people of our age group, was like, we definitely identify with wanting to be seen. But stuff that gives me like a similar vibe that's come out lately is we watched The House with the Clock in Its Walls.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
It's basically Jack Black, who, yes, please. Just unequivocally, yes, please. He plays the eccentric uncle who is like a wizard magician or whatever. And he lives in this house that has like some kind of crazy mechanical clock underneath and inside the house. Cate Blanchett is in it. She plays like a witch whose entire everything is purple. All of it. Her hair is purple. Her clothes are purple. Her house is purple. And it's like the nephew that comes to live with him after his parents pass away. You know, that 90s sort of my parents are gone. Coming of age, trying to find where you fit.
How grief and growth intersect to make a coming of age story.
Plus your house has a great big mechanical what's in the flotchy underneath.
Exactly. We can all relate to that, right?
So that's why it gives me like a similar vibe of Casper in terms of modern movies. As an adult watching it, it didn't land the same way emotionally, but maybe for kids who watch it, it will become their new Casper as time goes on.
Sometimes I'll watch something and be like, I can't even imagine what it's like to be a kid watching this. They must be freaking psyched.
Right?
So we talked about Brad Silverling. It's a woman-written movie. Yay.
And you can tell.
Written by Sherry Stoner and Deanna Oliver, like I said earlier. Sherry Stoner was the voice of Slappy the Squirrel in Animaniacs.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
Amazing.
She was also the reference model for Ariel and Belle. Ariel bites her lip and Belle plays with her hair, or vice versa. I can't remember, but those are both literally taken from her. And then Deanna Oliver was the voice of the brave little toaster.
Oh my God.
And wrote for Animaniacs and Tiny Toons.
Amazing.
So I love that these people who wrote this were just like so tapped into the 90s.
It's just blowing my mind. Now I'm picturing like the face of Ariel with Slappy's voice coming out of it.
Oh my God, that's so good. Somebody please put that together. And now the producer, Colin Wilson, was the assistant producer of Jurassic Park.
Yes!
He also produced Small Soldiers.
Oh, I fucking love that movie.
So good. Hey, Kirsten Dunst. He also produced The Haunting, which we've talked about. And then The Meg.
So what I get is like Sharks and Jaws to you is akin to Jurassic Park to me.
I also really like Super Athletic Bald Men.
Is it Jason Statham?
It is. Jason Statham in sweaters.
I get it very confused with Deep Blue Sea, which I think is Thomas.
Oh, I love Deep Blue Sea.
But that I think that's has Thomas Jane.
Yeah. Yeah. I was telling my partner, I was like, Thomas Jane is a fox because we love The Expanse.
I was just like, he's such a fox. Yes, yes,
and I'm like, why are you looking at me like that? Like, no, Thomas Jane is totally a fox. Am I the only one who thinks this? And he's like, I think so. And then I came back to him a few days later and was like, he plays the hot shark expert in Deep Blue Sea. And if he was cast in that, there's at least one other person that thinks he's a fox.
Also, the sweetest thing.
I love that movie.
It's wildly inappropriate.
Oh, so inappropriate. But I do feel like it was the first movie that I saw that represented the filthy side of female friendship.
Yeah, it was a raunch comedy made for women.
When they find out that Selma Blair's character had an incident on her dress and they're like chucking it over her, like Piggy in the Middle. I was like, yeah, no, that's
accurate.
So good.
And then also The Punisher.
Yes. Man, I haven't seen that movie in a long time. And now two other, I think, very pivotal parts of any supernatural horror. The director of photography and the composer. Director of photography, Dean Cundey, worked on many, many films. He was the DP for Back to the Future, Death Becomes Her, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh my God, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I could talk for years about.
Years. Steven Spielberg's movies, Hook and Jurassic Park.
Oh my God, Hook!
And he was the DP for John Carpenter's Halloween, Escape from New York, The Thing, and Big Trouble in Little China. I don't know if you're listening to this and you're not a horror person, but cinematography is like one of the most important things. And it's the same with all movies, but like there's a very specific thing about the horror lens. It's such a legit lens that they've made this kids movie through that validates all the horror feels. And then the composer, James Horner, mm-hmm. Wrath of Khan, An American Tale, Willow, Lamb Before Time.
Oh,
Titanic, Mask of Zorro,
oh
The Page
God.
Master, Jumanji, The Rocketeer.
The Rocketeer!
Focus, focus!
Okay.
And then I have to talk about the cast in this movie quickly.
Absolutely.
Obviously, Christina Ricci. Bill Pullman, I think, became all of our hot dad.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, hopefully, our friend's hot dad. I don't know much about the guy who did Stretch's voice, though I do know he did Stretch's voice for like all the games and cartoons after that. Stinky's voice was done by Joe Alasky, and he was one of Mel Blanc's successors. So when Mel Blanc died, he took over a few mm-hmm. of his characters. And then, of course, as we said, Fatso, Brad Garrett, Vic, the crush from school, was in Mighty Ducks. Amber, played by Jessica Wesson, played Brad's girlfriend in Home Improvement and was also in Flipper.
Ghostbusters! I was just thinking, like, the reason that I connect this movie with Ghostbusters so much is because it has Dan Aykroyd, who you're gonna call someone else.
Totally.
I wanted to circle back just one sec about James Horner. I was trying to remember all the things that I remember him from. But James Horner did a lot of emotionally impactful films targeted at children. So in addition to, like, Land Before Time, We're Back, A Dinosaur
I love that movie.
Story, which actually is fucking sad.
It's so good and so sad. I own it on VHS.
The Page Master.
Yeah.
Jumanji, like, is a bunch of feels.
Robin Williams' face acting. It's heartbreaking.
I didn't know he did Bicentennial Man, which is also fucking sad. But yeah, so he starts and there's a lot of emotionally impactful films as children. But like, as it goes on, it's more like, it's almost like his scores are growing with the people that are most familiar with them. Because then he's doing things like Avatar and The Boy in the Striped Pajamas and The Amazing Spider-Man with Andrew Garfield. I don't know.
I think there's a big correlation between whimsy and woe. And it's nice when a composer takes the family film seriously to combine those two, and he obviously does, especially since I think we've all died in the scene with Land Before Time.
Yeah, Littlefoot, but also like Jumanji hits hard in terms of children's emotions. Yeah. Which is also another film that's about dealing with grief. Children's outlets for grief reoccurs a lot in this period of time in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, does something happen? Like, were we too little? Something happened. We were too little. Remember that people needed help processing or what?
I don't know. It must have been that same thing that I was talking about where like families were constantly divorcing and we had more of a separated relationship with all these things. And I just hit my mic.
It's so fascinating to me that like all of these things kind of came together in a really beautiful way that resonates to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And we also love that one moment, that shining moment where we saw Devon Sawa and we were all Christina Ricci swooning about it.
Getting a little blush on our face.
Right. Like if we chemistry tested with him, we'd be like, oh, also. It was a moment.
Yeah. No, I think so many girls.
People.
Yeah.
Not just girls. People.
Oh, no. He's literally been interviewed by a gay gentleman who was just like, you in Now and Then. Oh, my goodness. So, yeah. People of all genders were swooning after him.
Yep. And so it gives us, you know, still ways to connect after all this time. And it helps process our emotions and... You know, we say we're sorry, Devon Sawa, but like, you know, how it began was the first flutterings of swoony feelings where we wanted to be Christina Ricci floating above a ballroom with a cute boy who proved himself so worthy that an angel turned him into a real boy for an evening.
And was so beautiful, and he really just wanted to hug and dance that weirdo.
Yeah.
That little woman who did not fit into society, and he just wanted to embrace her so much and wanted to like tell her that she was seen and she wanted to tell him the same. And I think that's like one of the really beautiful, sad moments of it. And it helps you try not to think about the complications of that 12-year-old ghost kissing this 12-year-old girl. And then she's apparently somehow going to grow up in his house.
I just feel like, can I keep you? Roll credits, because that's why we named the podcast this. But it's just such a pure, beautiful moment to let her know he is her person.
The can I keep you thing, he knows that he's never going to grow up. But the idea of being able to see her grow up and have her be present, even if he can't quite grasp it, he understands that she will always be one of his people. And he really just wants to be one of her people, even if he's dead, because like the Harveys are Casper's way to
finish his unfinished business.
And his uncle's, because he can barely remember anything. And it's only once he meets Kat that he even remembers how he died. He literally cannot remember his humanity. And so how can you move on if you don't remember your humanity? And so he chooses these people. And so, yeah, it doesn't matter. But at the same time, for all of us living folk, finding someone you can keep, whether it's romantic or not, is one of the most amazing things in the world.
So small tangent. Building on that, my husband and I met when we were in the fourth grade. He showed up at the door of the classroom as a new kid who'd moved around several times, very much like the Kat vibe. And I said, sit next to me and be my friend. And that was the first thing I ever said to him. And that's what we were. And then he moved away again. He moved to England. And that seemed like a whole entire other planet. We lost touch for years and years and years because life happens.
And the internet wasn't the same, kids.
And he did have my phone number, but, you know, there was a whole area code thing where the Vancouver Island was given a different area code than the rest of the province. So the phone number he had connected to someone else all of a sudden. And so through a series of really unfortunate events, we lost touch. And then like in 2006, around Christmas, a girl I went to high school with asked me like, do you know this person who moved to England in 1996? And I said, I absolutely know him. I absolutely know exactly who you're talking about. I have never, ever forgotten this person because even so young, I recognized that he was one of my people. No matter how that was going to turn out for us, and then we started talking and it was just like, I know this person is meant to be part of my life. And then when he came to visit me the first time I saw him, I was like, yep, no, this is it. This is everything for me.
And I think that a phrase like, can I keep you, just encapsulates love and friendship and your people.
And like connecting with someone that you want in your life for the whole entirety of it.
Yeah, and it can take so many forms. It could be a partner. It could be the father of your children. It could be a 12-year-old ghost that wants a house that I don't know how they have a claim to it after Kerrigan dies, but it seems like they just kept living there. Squatting? I think they squatted.
Maybe.
Nobody's going to come after them. They're all afraid of the house and Kerrigan's dead.
Yeah, and like nobody wants it because then now they know it's haunted because Casper turns back into a ghost in the middle of a Halloween party.
This movie is full of beautiful slapstick comedy as well as grief, like Kerrigan's death, Dr. Harvey's death. Oh my God. There was this article
talking about like, so this thing turns ghosts back into people. It rebuilds them. So Dr. Harvey just died. His body is still in the ditch.
Oh no. So then it like builds a new body. What do they do with his old body? Oh my God. Spoiler warning for The Prestige with Hugh Jackman and Christian Bale, but this is very, very prestige-y in nature because what happens to the other body?
Okay, so the 1995 movie Casper is deeply upsetting and we need to talk about this by BJ Colangelo. That's probably not right, but I'm sorry.
I mean, the whole thing is he's a child ghost, so we're really starting off on an upsetting kind of foot.
The Lazarus machine reanimated the ghost of Dr. Harvey, but his fleshy corpse is still at the bottom of a fucking manhole.
Right? Also, I've just decided that the reason that the bed say Stretch and Siggy and Fatso is because while their brother was an eccentric inventor, the trio was like a comedy trio a la the Three Stooges. And so I have no idea what the real story is, but I've decided they were traveling around doing their comedy act, and that was part of it, was that they had to be referred by their comedy names, and then they had to move back to the mansion to help their distraught brother after the death of his presumably his wife, and then also his only son.
Do you think that the ghostly trio over time forgot who they were and that's why they became so mean? Because they just thought of their comedy personas and they were like very...
Yes, we're making that executive decision right now. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, that's how it is. They exist in these personas because that was the most present thing in their minds. And because they're celebrities, they're used to being served, which is why they treat Casper like a servant, not like a nephew.
100%.
We've just decided the council of Halloweeros has spoken. This is the official backstory. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll probably visit Casper again at some point, just even to talk about our favorite moments. We'll see what happens, but thank you so much for joining us. And please rate, like, share, subscribe, leave comments, but hopefully not mean ones.
Only nice ones.
Constructive criticism is fine, but don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick.
Don't be a dick. And if you leave us nasty messages, I'm like, I may have sassy things to say back to you. So just save us all the trouble.
And don't be a dick.
Yeah. Tell us how you feel about 1995 seminal masterpiece Casper.
Do you have any, what is it, dark supernatural horror comedy or whatever it is?
Things that live at the intersection between funny and scary, but in a lighthearted way.
Yeah.
Give us your recommendations.
What moved you? What age were you when these came out? Let us know.
I'm also going to throw out, I recently read My Best Friend's Exorcism by Grady Hendrix, which is set in the 1980s, so it's got some 80s vibes and
oh, nice.
Some 80s era not-so-greatness.
Yep.
But it definitely gives me like goosebumps. Are you afraid of the dark, scary comedy friendship?
Oh, nice. Speaking of Jack Black, I haven't seen anything but the first Goosebumps movie, but I thought it was so sweet and they just did a really good job planning that. I don't know. He was great in it. He's great in everything.
Yes, we are also like a part-time Jack Black appreciation society. Like it's in, you know, our fine print of our society charter. Just remember, this isn't the greatest song in the world. This is just a tribute.
To Devon Sawa, not Jack Black. So yeah, do you want to... next episode is about?
Tune in next time for a discussion of Devon Sawa's recent work, Gasoline Alley, starring Devon Sawa, Luke Wilson, and Bruce Willis. My diehard John McClane, Bruce Willis.
He's my diehard John McClane. None of the other John McClanes are my diehard. This episode and our next episode are directly inspired by a meme that Devon Sawa posted a while ago. I'm sure you all remember the How It Started, How It's Going meme. And he posted it and it said How It Started. It was a picture of him and Casper and How It's Going. And it was a picture of him in Gasoline Alley. So that was definitely inspiration. And I don't know, I'm pretty excited to watch this. Rotten Tomatoes has been absurdly mean to it, but I think it's going to be a good ride.
Listen, I have seen so many Nicolas Cage films that he just did for the money. Talking about you.
Wicker Man.
Wicker Man, yeah.
Funny story, Wicker Man, the bees, it's a deleted scene. Don't watch the movie hoping that you're going to get to see it.
Killing me, will bring back your honey. We're going to have to edit this, definitely.
Now I'm not going to edit that out.
I, as a person, am 100% more likely to watch the film that is given the Golden Raspberry Award for Best Picture at the Razzies than I am to watch, like, a Best Picture nominee that just looks purposefully like Oscar bait that I probably will just be, like, sad and bored by.
I love a person who shows up to collect their Razzie.
Right?
They are the kings and queens and NB of Hollywood.
My liege. Kick-ass Duke. But yeah, so at one point I did want to be a screenwriter.
Me too.
Well then, clearly, we should collaborate.
Hey, Christina Ricci, Devon Sawa. I look forward to making our film together.
But I'm like, if we win a Razzie, I will personally show up, and if they play me off the stage, I'll be like, no, this is my moment. This is my moment, and you gave me an award, so you get to listen.
You guys sat through my 2.5 hour long movie. You can sit through my 5 minute speech.
I am a DC fan through and through, and if I can watch the entire Snyder Cut of the Justice League and not even have to get up to pee, you can sit through my 5 minute speech about my movie that you didn't even like. Thank you.
Absolutely.
It's just respectful.
And we're big on respect, which is why we
apologize to Devon Sawa on every episode.
So sorry, Devin Sawa. We're so sorry, Devin Sawa. And yeah, so we'll leave it at that. Thank you for listening. Like and subscribe. Check out our Instagram. Leave us a nice comment and or constructive criticism. And we're so sorry, Devin Sawa. We're
just very, very sorry.
Please be our
Can I Keep You is brought to you by the Devin Sawa Appreciation Society. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Can I Keep You Pod. Listen, follow, and leave us a review on the Podbean app or wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we're sorry, Devin Sawa.